loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we'll discuss the latest meeting of the Global Coalition to Counter ISIS and the use of similar coalition formations now and in the past as a fig leaf for U.S. military intervention abroad. And then we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, an international conference of neutral countries will be held today in Uruguay to jumpstart a dialogue between Venezuelans seeking a way out of the current crisis sparked by the U.S.-orchestrated effort to install Juan Guaido as Venezuela's president. Spokesmen for the governments of Uruguay and Mexico said they expect at least 10 countries to be represented at the talks today in Montevideo. Next, the Virginia Democratic Party is in a state of collapse. Senior Democrats around the country are calling for Governor Ralph Northam to resign after allegations that he appeared in blackface and with a friend dressed as a Ku Klux Klansman while in college. Attorney General Mark Herring also admitted to appearing in blackface while in college, and Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax is being accused of sexually assaulting a woman. If all three are forced to resign, as appears increasingly likely, the Republican House Speaker would be governor. He became Speaker after an election was decided by drawing lots from a hat. Then it's time again for our weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And then Jill Abramson, the former executive editor of the New York Times, is being accused of plagiarizing portions of her new book, Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts, which purports to be an expose of Vice News. Abramson told Fox News yesterday that she had no comment other than to deny plagiarism, but Vice News released a carefully annotated side-by-side comparison of the book, along with passages from Time Out and the New Yorker magazines and the Columbia Journalism Review that show uncanny similarities. And finally, Israel's Minister of Justice, Ayelet Shaked, who now co-chairs a new political party called the New Right, recently posted a tweet accusing the Israeli right-wing party Likud of being left. That's a common put-down right now in Israel, but what it really means is the accused is weak and unwilling to kill Palestinians. And in other headlines, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted to forward to the full Senate Attorney General nominee William Barr for a final confirmation vote. The committee vote was 12-10, split along party lines. Barr was Attorney General during the George H.W. Bush administration and played a key role in expanding the country's mass incarceration policies. Today, the House Foreign Affairs Committee voted to pass to the full House of Representatives H.R. 37, which would prohibit U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. The bill was introduced by Representative Ro Khanna. The committee voted 25-17 to approve the measure. The German government has imposed new restrictions on Facebook's ability to collect users' data. An official in a government anti-monopoly body said, quote, "In future, Facebook will no longer be allowed to force its users to agree to the practically unrestricted collection and assigning of non-Facebook data to their Facebook accounts," unquote. Facebook said it was planning to challenge these new regulations. White House Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said today that it is unlikely that President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping will meet again before March 1st, which is the deadline for the two countries to make a trade deal before a tariff truce negotiated at the end of last year expires. President Trump has made optimistic statements about the progress of the negotiations, but his administration is divided on the question. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the U.S. using coalition formations as a means to achieve military or foreign policy goals of the United States. Just think of the coalition to defeat ISIS, the coalition of the willing, that was the Iraq War, the coalition that overthrew the Libyan government, the Lima Group, and others. But these international coalitions are really just a myth. They serve as a cover for U.S. intervention around the world in the absence of a United Nations Security Council resolution or other international approval for military action. We are joined from London by Alexander Makouris. He is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. We're joined from Honolulu by Anne Wright. She is a retired United States Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, and she resigned to protest the U.S. invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. And later in the segment, we'll be joined by Kim Ives. He is the editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. And we are joined here in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show. Welcome, everyone.
Happy to be here.
Happy to be here.
We're glad to have you. So we want to take a big picture look at these coalitions that the United States tends to put together historically to justify and provide a fig leaf for the different interventions and wars they wage around the world. Just this week, the Global Coalition to Counter ISIS had its meeting. Mike Pompeo was there. He was trying to sort of reassure some of the U.S., well, allies is one way to put it, that, you know, the U.S. military presence will be there for a long time. But of course, that's something that President Trump has not been, you know, 100% clear on. Alexander, let's start with you. Focusing first on the Global Coalition to Counter ISIS, that summit, what do you think the most important developments were?
I think that the point about this war against ISIS is that, of course, it's largely now run its course if we talk about ISIS. So given that, you know, the war against ISIS is no longer really an extant war because this is yesterday's organization, why do we have to have a global coalition anymore? It seems to be more, once again, an attempt to keep a whole bunch of countries together in order to keep U.S. influence going. And you said right at the start of the program that the United States has a habit of putting together these ad hoc coalitions. And I think this is the right one. This is an example of one, because, as I say, it isn't really relevant any longer to the situation on the ground in the Middle East, where ISIS, it seems to me, as an organization, as a major overarching threat, which it did, it definitely was a few years ago, it seems to me that is now over, and we should be looking instead at the Middle East, not on a coalition of this nature, but on a coalition, if you like, or at least a consensus about how to put countries like Syria and Iraq back together.
And right, I mean, there's a fierce debate going on in U.S. politics right now about the future of U.S. troops. Well, in a number of countries, but particularly intense is the debate over the U.S. troop presence in Syria. What's your take on all this? I mean, is this, you know, a pretext, more or less, this idea that ISIS is still a potent threat, a pretext for the maintenance of those troop installations?
Well, I think so. I mean, if we look at the past 15 years, I actually resigned 15 years ago in opposition to the war in Iraq. And one of the things that happened when I was still a diplomat trying to figure out if I was going to stay in the government or not was this whole coalition of the willing, which the Bush administration was putting together to be a part of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, where the U.S. threatened countries essentially with, if you don't participate in this coalition, we're going to cut off your military aid, we're going to cut off your economic aid. And that's one of the things that I was being forced to do as a U.S. diplomat in Mongolia, to go to the Mongolian government to say, if you don't contribute to the coalition of the willing, there goes all of your U.S. aid. And that was one of the points that I used. I told my ambassador, I'm not doing this. This is blackmail for sure. And I think that the U.S. will continue to have these coalitions using U.S. power to cajole countries to stay in coalition with them, particularly, you know, even though we say that ISIS is almost defeated, well, it may be defeated in geographic terms and that the caliphate may not have as much hold, but they've got thousands of people that are in these cells that are going to be coming back. I think that's exactly what the U.S. will be saying to the coalition members. You've got to stay with us because there are ISIS groups that are in Africa. There's the threat. Now, this is I don't believe this, but this is what the U.S. government will be saying. You know, the threat of Iran, and we've got to stay together because you know, we'll need you for future work, so to speak, in not only the Middle East region, but in Africa.
Yeah, very good point. Alexander, go ahead. We'll get back to the historical example of the coalition of the willing, quote unquote, in the Iraq war. That's so important. But go ahead about, why this grouping is being held together, maybe cajoled to stay together. Is it possibly for a future aggression against Iran?
I think there may be an agenda about this, but I think more it is, if I have to be frank, that the United States has suffered a series of defeats, or at least maybe not the United States itself, but those who support interventionism by the United States in the Middle East have suffered a set of defeats. And I think they want to keep some kind of presence together and some kind of grouping of states together. And of course, ISIS, which is a murderous terrorist organization, provides an attractive bogey to do that. And then that way, by keeping that presence in the Middle East going, you set up a situation where you can say, well, the United States is the essential part of the Middle East. It is the peacemaker, if you like, there. And of course, because it has this key role, we are going to use that presence that we have in the Middle East, which is legitimized by these kind of coalitions, to pursue anti-Iranian policies and to, if you like, go after Iran. If you listen very carefully to Mike Pompeo's speech in Cairo, his recent speech in Cairo, he was basically talking in that way. He was talking about the positive role, as he spun it, of the United States in the Middle East. And I think that this is essentially what these coalitions now are trying to preserve. It's a way of making the United States' presence there appear legitimate, and to give the people who want an interventionist policy in the Middle East a ground to say that this is internationally supported.
Yeah, let's explore that issue of legitimacy. I mean, Anne Wright, is there any basis under international law for the U.S. to have a presence in Syria, or really even under U.S. law when we think about the authorization of the use of military force that this is done under?
Well, when one considers that Syria is an independent nation and the United States has not been invited in by the government of a sovereign country, of course it has no legitimacy at all. It follows the path, though, of decades, if not centuries long, of the U.S. deciding it's going to do something in somebody else's country, and to hell with international law. The U.S. just goes ahead and does it anyway. So the legal aspects of this has been thrown out the window long, long ago.
Now, let's explore some of the historical angles. These are all important points to be bringing up that are completely left out of the mainstream discourse in the United States, with a couple notable exceptions. But we've got to remember that, like, we've seen this movie before. You know, this is not a new maneuver for the United States to put together these types of coalitions. Alexander, your country, you're in the UK. They were a part of the Coalition of the Willing. Tell us more about that, and then we'll get Anne Wright's experience from the U.S. side.
I think your other guest actually puts her finger on a very important point, because, of course, one of the functions of that coalition of the willing that was sort of cobbled together to fight the war against Iraq in 2003 was that it was a device to try to get around the fact that the war against Iraq had not been supported by the United Nations Security Council. And, of course, the same thing was done a little earlier when NATO was used to justify a war that was at that time being fought against Yugoslavia. And increasingly, one gets the sense that one of the roles of these so-called coalitions that are put together by the United States when it wants to intervene in a particular country is because it's finding it increasingly difficult to get its way in this United Nations Security Council. It creates these coalitions as a way of circumventing the Security Council. And I'm afraid Britain plays a consistent role in supporting these things. So, for example, a little while ago, just a few months ago, when the United States, after another chemical weapon attack in Syria, found it, you know, decided to intervene militarily in Syria. It went to its various allies, to Britain and France and the others, and put together an ad hoc coalition in order to launch this military strike it wanted to launch against Syria. Britain was there supporting it, and that again was able, made it possible for the United States to say, well, this that we are doing, it may not be internationally recognized by the UN Security Council, may not have been authorized by the Security Council, but we see that important countries around the world support us in doing it, and therefore, by implication, it is legitimate, even if, as your guest correctly said, in reality, it is not.
And if I could add to that, the Downing Street memos that came out in 2004 and 5, which showed that the legal counsel of the government of the UK was saying to Tony Blair, you can't do this. This is illegal. We can't do this sort of thing. And yet Tony Blair overruled his legal counsel. George Bush's legal counsel, of course, was saying, go ahead and do it. You know, the Bush legal team was inventing all sorts of legal constructs to provide Bush some sort of a legal platform to tell the American public that this was a legal military operation, when in fact it certainly was not. But the scandal that really erupted when the Downing Street memos came up, and Lord, I think it was Goldsmith, was the chief attorney, his memo saying, this is not right, this is wrong, you can't do this. That really bolstered us in the United States, where we were fighting desperately against the Bush administration's legal theories on this. And then finally, you know, the Downing Street memos come out, and the British legal team was saying, it's absolutely illegal to do this.
You know, this is an ongoing theme, too. We talk about this on the show all the time, but there are only three ways that you can intervene in another country. That's if the country attacks you, if you are invited in by that other country, or if you have the approval of the United Nations Security Council. And it's a shame that we have to keep repeating that over and over and over again. Every American should know that that is the law. That is international law. And it's not up to us to just decide that we're going to intervene in country A or country B because we don't like them, or we don't like their politics, or we don't like their worldview, or whatever it is. And then there's no pushback, whether it's from the American public or even from the international community. It's like they're used to it.
Let me just reintroduce everybody, because we're also joined here in studio now by Kim Ives. He is the editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. Kim Ives, welcome.
Thank you, Brian.
We're also talking with Alexander McCourris from London. He's the editor-in-chief of the Duran. We're joined from Honolulu by Anne Wright. She is a retired United States Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan. And Anne Wright resigned, a rare moment of principle in the U.S. government. Anne Wright resigned in protest of the Bush-Cheney-ordered invasion of Iraq, and she is today an anti-war activist. Alexander, you are going ahead. Go ahead.
I think what we heard about those memos, and I should say, by the way, that I used to know Lord Goldsmith very well, it is exactly to the point. And of course, it is essential to say that any attack on the United Nations system is an attack ultimately on the whole system of international law, because it revolves around the United Nations and the Charter, the United Nations Charter, and the role of the Security Council. But going back to your original questions about these coalitions, these ad hoc coalitions, the reason, one, I think, critical reason why we do not get enough pushback against these actions, these unilateral actions by the United States, which violate international law, is precisely because of the success the United States has had in creating these ad hoc coalitions, which somehow manages to conceal the fact that it is acting against international law. It becomes very easy for the United States to say, we cannot be acting against international law if powerful and important countries like Britain and France and Germany and Canada and others are supporting us in what we do.
Let's bring Kim Ives into the discussion. Kim, we're talking about the fact that the U.S. creates these mythical coalitions. It's really the United States with the the fig leaf of multilateral or international legitimacy. When the United States doesn't have the UN behind it, it uses NATO. If it can't get NATO behind it, it uses something they create called the Coalition of the Willing, for instance, or something we called in the Answer Coalition, the Coalition of the Bribed and Coerced. By the way, John Kerry stole that line, but and it didn't help him in the 2004 election.
Indeed,
but
it didn't.
But there are instances where the United States isn't required to have ad hoc coalitions. There are times when the United States, just by its sheer power, is able to manipulate things at the United Nations. And certainly for the people of Haiti, that's been true, and it's been pretty catastrophic.
Right. We saw that in 2004 when they were able to horse trade and bully and bribe to get a resolution to send troops into Haiti. And the result was the what was called the UN mission to stabilize Haiti. It was supposed to be there for 6 months, Brian and John, and it ended up being there for 14 years. This is how it works. But, you know, this is, of course, the new paradigm. It used to be that the U.S. kept its empire under wraps with strongmen, military dictators, caudillos in different countries. And then it changed really around the time of Carter, where they started to say, and he started to come with this whole human rights campaign. We remember Andrew Young going around reading the Riot Act to people. He did in Haiti as well. And so the new formula is the international peacekeeping body. That is, I think that the international UN force, or the in the case of Haiti, or in I think what they're trying to work for now in Venezuela is the OAS, using the Democratic Charter, the International Democratic Charter. I forget the name, passed on September 11, 2001. And if they can get 22 countries of the 34 or 35 countries of the OAS, I mean, Honduras isn't voting right now because of the coup there, but they are able to send in a peacekeeping force, just as they did in the Dominican Republic in 1965. So, this is the approach. And I think it's also part of this whole sort of the transnational shift we've seen in the bourgeoisie. It used to be each bourgeoisie was sort of fending for themselves, the British, the French, and now we have this transnational group. And so we start to see more of these transnational efforts. In Haiti, and for instance, of late, they've started to use a thing called the Club of Madrid. And that's all the former presidents of this transnational class, everybody from Bill Clinton to Oscar Arias, who was president of Costa Rica, Jose Aznar, Michel Bachelet of Chile, Felipe and Calderon and Vicente Fox of Mexico, Mikhail Gorbachev. I mean, these are the people they are using to sort of muscle countries into line that aren't towing the line.
And right, let's just go back again and try to establish when does something become legitimate from the point of view of intervention. It seems to me that the United States, you know, we're talking about Haiti in 1915, Woodrow Wilson ordered the U.S. Marines and Army into Haiti. They went in, they took the country's gold, they brought it back to the First City National Bank, and now Citibank in New York. They didn't have to dress it up with some noble cause. They just took it because they could. Today, because of the sensibilities of the modern era, there does need to be a pretext. But I'm just wondering what motivates, from your point of view, the subcontractors or the junior partners in this relationship? Is it really bribery and coercion? Is it the power of the United States?
Well, it's money for sure. I mean, this is the big industry is war. And the more conflicts the U.S. can get involved in, the better the military-industrial complex corporations like it. And if you look at the number of, and it's a growth industry, if you look at the number of small groups that have formed up to be security people, to be small contractors in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Syria, and in Mali, and in all of these places, I mean, it's a big growth industry, and the morality of this for American contractors doesn't amount to a hill of beans. They don't care who we kill, how many we kill, what we kill them with. They're just ready to go out and be a part of the killing machine. And your first part of your question of what legitimizes these things that we know are truly illegal and unlawful, I would say it's the media. Whenever you can get the New York Times and the Washington Post to put on their front page, you know, and the TV stations to start cheering when cruise missiles go into Syria or all of that, then, you know, the media has a great deal to answer for when the people know this stuff is wrong. I mean, it would, if you look at the numbers of millions of people in February 2003 that were on the streets telling their governments, this is wrong, this is wrong. And yet the media is the one that helped the government push this thing through. So the citizen activism that we have is, well, that's about all we have right now. You know, that people have to recognize what's going on and hit the streets and try to rally others to force our government to not continue its historic movement, which is we do anything we want to whomever we want to, whenever we want to.
Yeah, it's interesting just on that front to see the coverage now in Venezuela. You see just wall-to-wall carpet coverage of the demonstrations in favor of Juan Guaido, and yet the larger demonstrations are in support of Maduro. You don't see a word, a syllable for that.
Yeah, go ahead, Alexander.
No, this is all absolutely right. I mean, the media part of this thing is an extremely worrying thing. It has become, if I may say so, the media is not just an accomplice in these operations. It is actually, essentially now, it seems to me, part of the governmental and political structure which is carrying them out. It is an essential part of them. They could not happen in the way that they do, if the media was functioning properly. But if I can just come back to a question that you asked, why do other countries participate in these kind of operations? Of course, in some countries, it's coercion. In some countries, it's bribery. In some countries, you know, little countries like Georgia, for example, which was part of the Iraq war, it's because they want to please the United States because they have their own particular agendas and they want the United States on their side. In a country like Britain and France, it is also a sense for them that having themselves lost their former imperial power, they are to some extent regaining it and their own influence by being part of this greater operation that the United States, which is their ally and godfather, if you like, is carrying out. So there is a very, very powerful sense of this, that a British Prime Minister like Tony Blair, he is attracted to doing it because it gives him a sense of power, even if it is not British power, but the US's power, which he is to some extent involved, or so he thinks, in controlling. So that is an important factor which I think should not be underestimated, and nor should one underestimate the skill with which some people in the United States and elsewhere have managed to sell these interventionist ideas by packaging them in humanitarian language. One of your guests referred to Andrew Young and how the Carter administration developed a whole language around human rights to basically, you know, defend or legitimize U.S. foreign policy. It is extraordinary today to see the extent to which that has developed. And I'm afraid that does have some pull on some people.
Kim Ives, 30 seconds left.
Exactly. It's intervention to protect, as they call it. And the one other one we can put in there is blackmail. And that's what was done to Haiti to get its vote in the most recent OAS vote, where Haiti stuck a knife in the back of Venezuela, which has supported it with about $4 billion in Petrocaribe money over the past 10 years.
Yeah, and Anne Wright, we'll give you the last word. 15 seconds left. I'm just looking at these recent studies that have come out in the last day about how the Pentagon has severely underestimated the number of civilian casualties from U.S. attacks. Instead of it being something like 1,000, it may be as many as 7,000 in, we're talking about Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, etc. Go ahead, 15 seconds.
The government lies. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
There it
all
is.
Right. All right. That was Anne Wright. Anne Wright is a retired U.S. Army colonel, former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq, and she became an anti-war activist. We're joined in studio by Kim Ives. He's the editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. We were joined from London by Alexander Makouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. And earlier in this interview, in this segment, we were joined by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik news analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
So much to talk about today. Kevin, I want to start with you. There was a terrible incident at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York, MDC Brooklyn. One of the things that I think many Americans don't understand is the existence of these metropolitan detention centers. There's a big one in Chicago, there's one in Manhattan, there's this big one in Brooklyn. They're all over the country. And they're maximum security prisons, but they're supposed to be temporary stops for people who are either awaiting trial and are deemed to be, for whatever reason, not appropriate for release, pending trial, or for prisoners who are awaiting transfer or transport to another prison. So on the 27th of January, in the midst of that week, the coldest week of the year with temperatures in the single digits, MDC Brooklyn lost power, and it didn't get back power for something like a week. Start us off by talking about that.
Yeah, this story is just a tale of neglect, basically, a tale of just how little people who are in positions of power actually care about the safety and well-being of prisoners. And time again, you know, we've articulated these kinds of stories, but this is maybe one of the more blatant and incredible examples that I can remember in the shows that we've done here. And I believe MDC, this federal jail here, is actually where Muslims who were religiously profiled were rounded up and sent after the September 11th attacks, and they were housed here and mistreated and abused, but there was never any justice for them to challenge people like Robert Mueller and others who were involved in their abuse. But here at this jail, what happened is, and I think you've got judges who are now interested in what's gone on. You've had such as attention to the kinds of mistreatment that was going on. And essentially what happened is you've had the judge, one of these judges, go and visit the prisoners there, go to the facility and see for herself exactly how there is this humanitarian crisis at this facility. So the lights going out have revealed that this detention facility is a place which is representative of a lot of different facilities in the U.S., which is representative of a lot of problems that really need to be addressed, that the incarcerated people there are not taken care of, that they might be left in the dark and cold, that there are medical crises, that there are mental breakdowns, that people who manage the facility aren't doing anything to address. And you have kind of like heart-wrenching exchanges, like, while men were pounding on the shoe, like just making a lot of noise, you have inmates reaching out to this judge as she was visiting to try and talk to her and tell their stories. And she even said, this inmate said, "Thank you very much. Thank you for being worried about us, ma'am, and treating us like human beings." And she said, "I'm very worried about you." I mean, like, it's just this like incredible pain and suffering going on that is only being exposed because they wouldn't turn the lights back on.
Let me read just a paragraph from a recent article in The Intercept. It says here that while many celebrated the moment the lights came back on in the federal jail Sunday evening and looked forward to the hearings promised by concerned legislators, cases in federal court over the past 2 days have made it impossible to ignore the fact that the humanitarian crisis at the federal detention facility extends far beyond the electrical fire that shut down primary power. Federal court hearings this week have revealed a staggering pattern of neglect. Incarcerated people left on their own, in the dark and cold, to deal with medical crises and mental breakdowns. One incarcerated person had to physically stop his cellmate from hanging himself. People housed at the federal jail reported that as many as 9 incarcerated people were left without potentially life-saving medical equipment because of the power shutdown. And another incarcerated patient was left with an untreated gunshot wound. We're talking about for a week. Well, when this judge that you mentioned, this is Judge LaShawn D'Arcy Hall, went to the facility to walk through it, she came out and said, "My problem is I don't trust the representations coming out of the Bureau of Prisons. I just don't." Another thing that she saw was black mold that was growing just unabated, out of control. And she said that on top of all these problems, with this Arctic weather, you know, temperatures in the single digits, these prisoners didn't even have adequate clothing. Now, when I was in the Federal Correctional Institution at Loretto, Pennsylvania, I was there for 23 months after blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program. We had heat in the winter, but even with the heat, temperatures would get down into the high 50s at night. And so we had to sleep in our winter coats. We had to be fully clothed and with our winter coats just to be able to sleep at night. And then every few hours, we would take turns chipping the ice off of the inside of the walls that had formed, you know, because of these low temperatures. Many of the housing units, not just at Loretto, but also at MDC Brooklyn, are not insulated. They're just concrete block built into the sides of hills or whatever. And so this ice forms just as a matter of course. Well, imagine if you've got heat and ice is still forming. Imagine what it's like when you have 7 days with no electricity and no heat and temperatures are in the single digits. Paul, you've experienced this kind of thing. Tell us what you've seen.
Well, I think that one of the things, unfortunately, in the United States prison legal news, we've reported every year, we report about prisoners that literally freeze to death. They die of hypothermia in detention facilities. You know, we've reported whole bodies of litigation where prisons are so cold that literally icicles are forming on the tiers. And that I think that, you know, and conversely, you know, on the one hand, prisoners are freezing in the winter in many places, and conversely, they're roasting in the summer. And then they report the dozens of deaths of prisoners, especially those that are taking medications that inhibit the body's ability to regulate heat, that are deliberately housed in prisons that were built with no air conditioning in places like Florida and Texas and Louisiana, where, you know, they're being exposed to basically death by heat stroke. And, you know, basically they freeze in the winter and, you know, roast in the summer, often with fatal consequences. And I think the bigger thing is that the government views this as, you know, views prisoners as a totally expendable population. And I think that, you know, the fact is that the power's out for a week, prisoners are being held with no heat and sub-zero temperatures and the coldest winter that's hit New York in years. And no one thinks that, well, maybe we if we can't set up an emergency power situation, if we can't heat the building on an emergency basis, maybe we need to evacuate them to either another federal facility or to Rikers Island or some other detention facility. And that never even occurs. And of course, you know, no one's losing their job over this. You know, the warden isn't being demoted or fired. No one's being held accountable for it. And, you know, we just see this repeatedly. I think also in New York when Hurricane Sandy came through, both federal and local jail officials in New York City, they were pretty proud of the fact that they weren't evacuating their facilities. They were not going to move the prisoners to a safer place. They're just like, you know, hey, we're just going to hunker down. And, you know, implicit in these statements and implicit in the way they treat the prisoners in their care and custody is that this is an expendable population. It doesn't matter if they live or die. It doesn't matter if they freeze to death or don't freeze to death. And, you know, yes, I've unfortunately had to experience this stuff myself when I was in prison in Washington State. Unfortunately, you know, we had situations where, you know, the prisons were really cold in the winter. And ironically, the old prisons, the ones that were built in at the turn of the 19th century, the early 20th century, still used steam heating. And generally, those were heated better than the more modern ones that required on forced air ventilation. So, you know, go figure.
Kevin, I wanted to add one thing and ask your comment on it. This isn't just an issue of being cold. There was more to it than that. Because there was no electricity, there was no heat. Because there was no heat, there was no way to heat the water. And because there was no way to heat the water, pipes froze, and there was no way to take a shower. They finally got the water going again after 72 hours, but the water was so cold that you couldn't expose your body to it. And so no one took a shower. On top of all that, because there was no electricity, there was no phone system. So you couldn't be in touch with the outside world, including with your attorneys. And because there was no electricity, there were no legal visits. And so these prisoners, many, many of whom are awaiting trial, were not able to speak with their attorneys on the phone. And because all visits were canceled due to the power outage, were not able to meet with their attorneys in person. Sarah Kunstler, whose father was Bill Kunstler, the famed defense attorney, said that she asked one of her clients, "Do you feel ready for trial in your case?" And he said, "No, I don't." And it's because he was simply unable to prepare for his own defense because of this power outage. And the Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Justice have done nothing to make good on any of this. Go ahead.
Well, it's a massive violation of rights. And I think there are probably countless civil lawsuits that will come out of the days that just unfolded. To add to what you're saying, I wanted to emphasize how this dehumanization in the cold weather extends outside the walls of the prison to when prisoners are being tasked with working for like shoveling snow. We're only 1 week out from when the polar vortex hit the Midwest, and there was a photo that went viral of prisoners who were out shoveling snow in very, very basic prison attire in conditions where the governor of Illinois had already declared a state of emergency because of the wind chill advisory that was plunging the city of Chicago into temperatures that were at least 30, if not 40 degrees below zero. And yet prisoners were out moving snow on the sidewalks, and the sheriffs were making claims that, hey, they're just fine. They're wearing their standard winter clothes, so they shouldn't have to worry about their health. And so it's clear that, like, as far as this neglect goes, there's also times when they aren't being neglected. And as you're talking about examples of being in prison, even when they're claiming to attend to prisoners, they're still not taking care of their health.
Yeah, that's true. Paul, I remember the prison asking for volunteers for what they called snow call. If you agreed to be awakened at 4 o'clock a.m., they would take you outside to begin shoveling snow. And it was, of course, inside the confines of the fences. But you got $1. You had to go out in your winter coat that they gave you. You could buy a hat from commissary if you had the money to do that. And there was no such thing as winter gloves in prison. But by God, people stood in line to earn that dollar.
Yes, and I think that's kind of like that the third world maquiladora model is what I call it, is where basically it's not that prisoners aren't being objectively exploited, it's just that the alternative is even worse than that, is being able to earn a dollar is better than not being able to have any money at all in prison. And the reality is that it takes a lot of money to be a prisoner these days in America. You know, to the extent that the state doesn't give you, the food ranges from bad to horrific. Prisoners pretty much need to supplement their food from the commissary. If you want basic hygiene items like shampoo or deodorant or things like that, you have to buy that. They charge you to go see the doctor to seek medical attention. So, you know, these are all things that require money. And so, yes, you know, people do wind up standing in line and trying to get these jobs, you know, if it's an hour a day to shovel snow, simply because the alternative is even worse.
Yeah, there are so many issues here. I'd love to talk about this for the whole segment, but there are such important stories that we need to go over. Paul, you just returned from a very important bench trial in the state of Arkansas. I was only vaguely aware that you were going down to argue this case, and then I read the Human Rights Defense Center email that was sent around where you explained exactly what this case entailed, and it sickened me. Go ahead and tell our listeners about what you were doing in Arkansas.
So basically, the Human Rights Defense Center, we publish two magazines, the Prison Legal News and the Criminal Legal News. These are monthly magazines that report on developments regarding prisons and criminal law. We also publish books designed to help prisoners help themselves. And so we learned about this jail in Mountain Home, Arkansas, which is Baxter County. And a small jail, it's around 130 prisoners on any given day. It's designed for 100, so of course it's overcrowded. And I have to say is that as someone who's been doing this stuff for over 30 years now, is really surprised that this is the first jail I've heard of where the prisoners aren't allowed to watch television, which that's kind of astounding. But then you couple that with the fact they can't get books, they can't get magazines, they aren't allowed to get newspapers, they can't get lettered mail. The only communications that they're allowed to get is on postcards. Oh, and they play the radio 20 minutes a day. They play the local radio station 20 minutes a day so they can listen to the news. And the sheriff actually makes a big deal about the fact that as far as feeding the prisoners that are only fed oatmeal in the morning, a bologna sandwich for lunch, and cornbread and beans for dinner. And he seems pretty proud of this. And I was actually really stunned when Dan Marshall was the HRDC attorney, he was our lead trial counsel, and he conducted a lot of the direct examinations. But our local counsel was asking the sheriff, does rehabilitation factor into any of your decisions? And he said no. And he said that the sheriff says, recidivism isn't really a concern of mine. And on his own website, he says that the jail has a 73% recidivism rate. And he thinks that's actually pretty good, that it's only 73%. And, basically the picture that gets painted is, I think it's pretty barbaric. I mean, and the interesting thing is that, throughout the trial, the defense lawyer, he continuously referred to us as an out-of-state plaintiff. And they said that, no one in the jail had complained, and which wasn't true. We had evidence showing that prisoners had, in fact, complained about it. But I think that's part of the thing that just seems kind of amazing is the fact that in 2019 in America, we have prisoners being so isolated from the outside world and their families and anyone else. The other testimony that came out was that they had no books at all in the jail. They'd had a book cart, and they discontinued that years ago. So literally, prisoners have literally nothing to read except for the Bible and maybe the Quran. And then their law library, unquote, those are my air quotes there, consists of literally a milk crate with four or five books that are over 20 years old and missing pages. So that's the extent of reading material in the Baxter County Jail in Arkansas.
So you said in your email that this was a bench trial and that the judge is going to make a decision in the coming months. I won't ask you to make a prediction, but do you have any feeling based on the judge's questions, what his thinking might be?
Well, I guess it's hard to predict what judges are going to do, and I think if I could do that, I'd probably be in a higher paying line of work. But the judge seemed concerned. I mean, he seemed concerned about the abysmal conditions in the jail. But the problem is that there's an Eighth Circuit opinion called Simpson, where the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the postcard only ban. And we think there's significant differences between our case here and the Simpson case, because namely we're challenging the ban on books and magazines and not just the ban on lettered mail. And the prisoners also seem to be significantly more isolated in this case than in our case than they are than they were in the other case. But the judge seems he seems sympathetic. At this point I'd say, difficult to say which way he's going to rule. One of the things that came across, I think, during the trial was that the judge thinks he owes deference to the jail officials running the jail, but I think one of the things that we were able to show pretty conclusively is that the sheriff either doesn't know what's going on in his own jail or he's just lying to the court. One or the other. The jail's expert, I think, was pretty thoroughly discredited in terms of, it comes across that basically, he wasn't familiar with the relevant standards. He'd never actually been to the jail. And none of the jails he'd been employed at had this type of draconian isolating policies and stuff. So just overall, though, I think that, I think it was a matter of the facts and the quality of the lawyering. I think that, we should win and prisoners should be able to get books and magazines in the Baxter County Jail. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that, it's going to be that conclusive.
Well, we're definitely going to ask you for follow-ups on this. I think this is a very important case. And I want to reintroduce you. We're talking with Kevin Gastala from Chicago. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And Paul Wright joins us from Lake Worth, Florida. Paul is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Kevin, the State of the Union was a couple of nights ago, and the president made a point of saying that he wanted a Trump administration to attack the spread of HIV and AIDS in America, and that he wanted to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS within 10 years. And then the Justice Department did something that actually proves exactly the opposite. Talk about that.
Well, yeah, and I'd also add that he said America is a country that believes in redemption, and yet now they're going to make it impossible for people to redeem themselves. So specifically, the Justice Department filed a civil lawsuit against a supervised injection site in Philadelphia that a nonprofit organization, as well as some leaders, former officials, including former Governor Ed Rendell, support having this site in what has become sort of the hub of the opioid epidemic in Philadelphia. And they would like to have this so that there can be supervision, so that also doctors can be there to help people not overdose. And then I think the idea is usually that you could wean them off and get them to some kind of drug treatment that people are going to use because they're addicted, but that you can try to get them off. Well, the Justice Department is saying that this is just illegal. They're not going to allow it. And while they're not pursuing some kind of criminal route, they do want to pressure and basically, I think, intimidate this nonprofit into not doing something compassionate for people who are struggling with drug addiction. I think that this is a smart move for the nonprofit organizations to be building this site because we should be interested in harm reduction. You don't want people to be killing themselves. But yet the Justice Department shows how they just don't really care about issues of redemption, et cetera, when they're pursuing this kind of civil lawsuit.
You know, one of the things that was surprising to me when reading about this case was how the law frequently does not catch up with society. One of the arguments that the Justice Department is using here in order to prevent this center from opening, this is a center that literally would save people's lives. It would literally prevent people from catching and dying of HIV and HIV-related diseases. It's something called the Crack House Statute. It's a 1986 federal law that makes it a felony punishable by up to 20 years in prison to, and this is a quote, to knowingly open or maintain any place for the purpose of manufacturing, distributing, or using controlled substances. So even if it's a clinic that is open to help prevent the spread of HIV and AIDS by offering a safe place for people who have addictions to nurse their addiction, I guess, and I would assume in advance of some kind of treatment, you can go to prison for 20 years for that. Paul, what's your experience in this area?
Well, I was going to say is, you know, one of the things that I think that's really barbaric about the statute is not just the statute, but I think their, you know, their effort to close down, you know, a safe injection site is that, you know, from an epidemiological perspective, we know from the research that the Center for Disease Control has done that 25 to 30% of all people that are HIV infected are going to cycle through a prison or a jail every year. And nothing is being done to, I mean, from an intervention perspective, you want to intervene with people's lives to, you know, get them medical care, get them treatment for the HIV. You know, let's leave aside the drug addiction. You know, the criminal justice population is the place to do it. Yet that's totally ignored. And I noticed that the president doesn't have any, you know, doesn't have any thought about or talk about ensuring prisoners get adequate medical care, of which the HIV would be a great place to do it. But, you know, historically, the federal government has opposed any efforts at harm reduction. And I think that, you know, after 40 years of a failed war on drugs, of, you know, a bulging prison population, tens of thousands of people dying of overdoses over the years, that this is an effort to basically, which has been successfully used in Europe and other countries, to, you know, reduce the harm. Because I think one of the common sense things is that if people are dead, they can't get help. And the purpose of safe injection sites, the purpose of this is to reduce the harm. And the theory is, you know, keep people alive. And as long as they're alive, they can see about either getting off drugs, resolving their addiction issues, or at least if that can't happen, at least they stay alive. And what we do know is that most people, with or without treatment, they age out of drug addiction. You know, most people are not drug addicts for their entire lives, and, you know, they age out of it, assuming they survive. And I think that's kind of like the big, that's kind of the big quandary here and what folks are trying to do. And that the Department of Justice is opposing it, I think, is because I think we get down to the thing, too, of how many, the jobs of how many prosecutors, cops, prison guards, et cetera, depend on the criminalization of drug use in this country and the prosecution of poor drug users rather than the efforts made to get people to stop using drugs or treating it as a public health problem or a public health issue as they do in many other countries. And I think that, you know, to put this into perspective as well, last year around 78,000 people died of drug-related overdoses related to opioids and illegal drugs, and over 500,000 people died as a result of smoking tobacco products. But no one's calling for the illegalization of smoking tobacco products. And one of the things we can say just in our lifetime, I mean, gosh, I remember I was in the Army 30 years ago and like 95% of the people smoked. And I think, you know, we see this just in our lifetimes that stop smoking campaigns have been successful. Very few people smoke today compared to how many people smoked even as recently as 30 years ago. And that was treating tobacco use as a public health issue, not treating it as a criminal problem. Yet the Department of Justice and basically the American police state, they vehemently oppose any effort to treat drug addiction as a public health issue. So, you know, they want to keep prosecuting their way out of this, and all we have to show for it is the biggest prison population in the world and 80,000 dead people a year.
That is it. Kevin, we have about 45 seconds left. There's one more article that just infuriated me. I'm sorry that I'm cutting your time short, but talk about how hundreds of bounty hunters had access to AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile customer location data for years.
Well, this is a story from Motherboard, and people can go look at it for more details. It's outraged Ron Wyden. It outraged Mark Warner, who are Democrats. And basically, this is a wholly unregulated industry of people chasing after wanted fugitives and then sometimes engaging in harassment and intimidation. Basically, they have your location data. This is something that should be really alarming to people who care about privacy protections, because this isn't happening under the auspices of any prosecutors, and they can harass people with this location data.
Absolutely right. We're going to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.